class this evening has the serious subject of belief and practice, and the subject specifically for tonight is duty and responsibility. And our brother Alan is going to address us upon that subject. Belief and practice, duty and responsibility.
Well, good evening, brethren and sisters. This is the first address in a series of five, and the others concern perseverance and adversity, Christian marriage, prayer, and attitudes to the world. And so we are going to try as far as possible, obviously, not to overlap any of those in our own thoughts this evening. So we'd like to begin by defining the terms that we're going to think about this evening, especially as the word duty is not a common Bible word, while in the translation of the Bible that I've got, the word responsibility is not found at all. So according to the dictionary, duty is the sense, in the sense we are considering, means a moral or a legal obligation. To be dutiful means the regular discharge of a duty, but can imply an eagerness to fulfill the duty, and not just the fulfillment of it, whether or not it's eagerly done. To be responsible, according to the dictionary, means a liability, to be called into account for something. And responsibility is a bit like being dutiful in that it implies an attitude of mind. It can carry the idea of doing something without an obligation or an authority, or where there's no guidance to take into account. It's something that's done in anticipation that questions may be asked about whether the responsibility has been fulfilled or not. So that's what the dictionary says. So let's see how far now we get in the Bible, starting again with duty. And we can look at almost all of the very few references in the scriptures. So perhaps we could turn to the first one in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 8 and verse 14. 2nd of Chronicles chapter 8 verse 14. And here we read about the reinstituted requirements of the law of Moses in the temple of Solomon. 2 Chronicles 8, verse 14 then. And he appointed, according to the order of David his father, the courses of the priests to their service, and the Levites to their charges, to praise and minister before the priests, as the duty of every day required, and so on. And we come across exactly the same wording in Ezra chapter 3, verse 4, which I'll read to you, Ezra 3, verse 4, which is a similar situation. And it says, they kept also the Feast of Tabernacles, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number, according to the custom, as the duty of every day required. One of the few other places in the Old Testament is in Ecclesiastes 13, verse 14, which reads, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. But in that case, the word duty is not actually in the original. The original, though, for duty, as we have it in these passages we have looked at, is translated in many other ways, so we're not going to spend any further time talking about those. Coming to the New Testament, the original in Greek is associated with a very wide number of applications, including giving thanks, being benevolent, being under an obligation to obey the law, to be responsible for debts and dues, whether literal or spiritual, and even in that familiar passage in Hebrews, with reference to Jesus, it behoved him, it was his duty, to be made like unto his brethren. And there are two well-known passages as well that we will be familiar with. And perhaps we can just turn over to those as well. The first is in Luke 17, verse 10. Luke 17, verse 10. As I say, these are very familiar when we read them. So likewise ye, when ye shall have done all these things, those things which are commanded you, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do. In other words, there was really no choice, and they did the best they could, even though they were still unprofitable. And the other one is in Romans chapter 15, verse 27. It's Romans 15, verse 27. It hath pleased them verily, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister unto them in carnal things. Now moving on to responsibility. And this is not a Bible word, but it is one that has entered into our Christadelphian parlance, and to which we have placed a very great significance. We say that we are responsible, or actually acknowledging a duty, when we have become aware of the need to act in a certain way. And that certain way is to obey the call of the gospel when we know what it means and what it requires of us. So in that situation, the idea of responsibility becomes the same as duty. And if we fail to obey the call of the gospel, then we shall still be subject to the judgment. Well, when I first sat down to put together these thoughts, I thought it might be useful to delve into when we become responsible in this context and exactly what we mean by it. But I think perhaps we are familiar enough with that subject. It is a first principle doctrine, and therefore we should be very familiar with it. But I do feel it is helpful to remind ourselves about the implications of becoming responsible in the way that we understand it. And here the Apostle Paul gives us some exposition in this letter to the Romans. He tells us there that at a basic level, all men have some responsibility towards God, because the natural world provides so much evidence for believing in his existence. But that's not sufficient. If it has never been revealed specifically to a man or woman what God commands, they cannot be judged for their lack of responsibility. It's the matter of calling, which is God's decision. At the beginning, the only human beings to exist knew about God, and they knew what they should do. God told them in the Garden of Eden. But subsequent generations lost that awareness totally. The Bible teaches that when they die, their end is permanent. There will be no resurrection, there will be no judgment, because they are not responsible. And further on in Romans, in chapter 5, Paul says, until the law, and that's God's law, not restricted to the law of Moses, until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law. So man dies because of sin, but neither responsibility nor prospect of salvation is applicable to those who have always been ignorant. The Bible exists, though, to teach mankind God's ways, his existence, his creation, his intention, the outworking of his purpose. His purpose was developed through a few faithful people before the flood, such as Noah and his family, and in a family line after the flood, starting with Abraham. In due course, the law of Moses became the code of conduct. But remember that the law of Moses did not change the principles of salvation, which had always existed since the promise in Eden, especially sacrifice for the remission of sin. And even more fundamentally, the recognition by the sinner of the need for sin to be repented of. And also we must remember that although the children of Israel were the chosen race, they did not have the absolute monopoly. And Israel were to remember that they too had been strangers. And thus God commanded them to respect those who by accident of birth were not of Israel, naturally speaking. And they too could be eligible to benefit from the promises made to the fathers. So one of the things that we well understand is that there were limitations in the law. And these limitations were drummed into the children of Israel because of their tendency to think that all would be well if they simply complied with the rituals and the offerings without giving thought for their significance. So look back at Deuteronomy chapter 10, where this is made very clear. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 12. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 12, reading down to verse 20. And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee, but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good. Behold, the heaven and the heavens, heaven of heavens, is the Lord's thy God, the earth also and all that therein is. Only the Lord had a delight in thy fathers to love them, and he chose their seed above after them, even you above all people, as it is this day. Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart, and be no more stiff-necked. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, a great God, a mighty and a terrible, which regardeth not persons nor taketh reward. He doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and the widow, and loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. Love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, him shalt thou serve, and to him shalt thou cleave, and swear by his name. So that was the fundamental principle. And much later on, it was repeated very clearly in Micah. And I'll just read to you what Micah says in chapter 6 and verse 6. Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He hath showed thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God? So none of the physical sacrifices would be of any use without recognition of the supremacy of God and the sinfulness of man, and this applied before the law of Moses as well. In addition, as Deuteronomy said, even though God chose to work out his purpose through Israel, it was a key requirement to regard the situation of other men as well, particularly those in need, and including the stranger. And this principle could not be made clearer than in the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I think it would be worth just turning that up in Mark chapter 12, verse 28. Mark chapter 12, verse 28. One of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, and perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, this is Jesus, which is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength, and with thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. And the second is like, namely this, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these. And the scribe said unto him, well, Master, thou hast said the truth, for there is one God, and there is none other but he. And to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love his neighbour as himself, is more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. And when Jesus saw that he answered discreetly, he said unto him, thou art not far from the kingdom of God. And no man after that durst ask him any question. So we now have, we think, a framework on which to develop our subject of duty and responsibility. We've looked at the meaning of the words from a Bible perspective. We've seen that duty and responsibility is all about recognizing God and then aligning our lives, every aspect of our lives, to his purpose and his praise. It means that our thoughts and our actions, our whole being, should be working towards the kingdom, ultimately the time beyond that. And the two key requirements are that we should love God and love our neighbour. And we love God because he is the creator, and we love our neighbour because that follows the love that God has for mankind. So what we now need to do is to think about how this impacts on our lives. There's an enormous difference between what we should be aspiring to and what we're surrounded by in the present life. Because everything about the present, in one form or another, is different from God's ways. And for this second part of our study, I found it very helpful to read Brother Islip Collier's book called Conviction and Conduct, published in 1968. It was obviously written in different times to our own, and as was the manner of writers in those days, it's somewhat wordy. But there are many helpful thoughts, and I'd like to share some of these with you as we think about our subject. And the particular section in his book is called Prepare to Meet Thy God, O Israel. Prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. And therefore it's a summary, really, of everything that's included in this topic of duty and responsibility. And that title is taken from a passage in Amos. So before we go into further thoughts, let's just think about this phrase. There's a comment by Brother Jim Broughton in the book in the series The Books of the Bible on Amos. And he says, in the first half of the 8th century BC, life had improved considerably in the land of Israel, at least for the upper classes. One might have expected that God's compassion on his people by thus subduing their enemies would have provoked some response of gratitude and reformation. On the contrary, the historical record in 2 Chronicles flatly states that on the accession of Uzziah's son Jotham, the people continued their corrupt practices. The revelation of God's mind through his servant Amos also includes certain principles which we need to note most carefully, the more so as they are almost universally disregarded nowadays. And one of these is put as a question. Do two walk together unless they have agreed to do so? In other words, are we aligned with the purpose, the will of God? And the prophecy ends with a wonderful vision of the kingdom, the destruction of Israel's enemies, and God's mercy upon them. So that, in summary, was what Amos said in his prophecy. And this is the passage where the words are found, prepare to meet thy God. It's in Amos chapter 4, verse 11, and this is how it reads. I have overthrown some of you, as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and ye were as a firebrand plucked out of the burning. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith the Lord. Therefore thus will I do unto thee, O Israel, and because I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. For lo, he that formeth the mountains, and createth the wind, and declareth unto man what is his thought, that maketh the morning darkness, and treadeth upon the high places of the earth, the Lord, the God of hosts, is his name. So the words come in the form of a very stern exhortation, because Israel in those days had failed to comply with those two key commands. Brother Collier's book doesn't talk sternly, but it does set the seriousness of the topic that we're thinking about, duty and responsibility. We need to prepare for the coming of Christ. And so in his book, he says, by more careful reading of the word, by examining ourselves, by giving more heed to faithful exhortations, by allowing the first principles of the oracles of God to be carried to their legitimate conclusion, in all these ways we may prepare ourselves for the great position to which God has called us. In the section titled The Power of Belief, he concentrates on the first commandment, to love God. This was repeatedly impressed on the children of Israel and then forgotten about almost as often as it was said. It illustrates how vital it is to keep repeating the command, since the natural indication is to go in the opposite direction and to love ourselves. Even the command to love our neighbour, which is sometimes easier for us to grasp and easier to comply with because it's more tangible, because it's something that we can apply every day and can be seen to comply with it, cannot be fully obeyed without loving God first. It's not enough to say that we fulfill the command to love God just by loving our neighbour. They are actually two commandments, and both are necessary. Right. Thank you. When we were baptized, the act of obedience that baptism was had nothing to do with loving our neighbour, but it was the first act of importance because we loved God. It was something we did because we believed God and we accepted what we had to do to please him. We may have to obey God in other ways which human beings would see contrary to loving our neighbour. But our first duty always is to obey God. So Brother Collier wrote, God is just And men who concentrate their attention on the service of humanity by no means lose their reward, and he's not talking about the kingdom. The affairs of temporal life engross their attention, and the affairs of temporal life will be their portion. In all generations, the first great law has been the first to be forgotten. There is some danger that we may unconsciously be influenced to go at least part of the way with polite but cultured serpents. And he means that doing good works are done by those who otherwise contradict God and what he said about obeying him first. There are times when it is the duty of God's servant to do things that seem contrary to the moral code, which is loosely based on the command to love our neighbour. We know this, but it's impossible to explain or understand unless we appreciate that the first command is to love God and obey him. Although, for example, we're told to govern our own lives in accordance with the command not to kill, it would be a sin to refrain from killing when we're actually told to do so by God. And there are many examples in the Bible that tell us this. Saul was condemned when he spared Agag, especially when he explained his specious reasoning. The children of Israel were told to destroy their enemies when they entered the land of promise. They had their explanation when they failed, but soon they came to realize that their failure marred their inheritance of that land for generations. The case of David is extremely instructive, but it's full of contradictions if we only view it from a human standpoint. There are two aspects of David's life that are worth thinking about. The first is about his sin with Bathsheba, and the second is about his ambition to build the temple. David was a privileged man when he became king, and yet he was a robber, an adulterer, and to all intents and purposes, he was a murderer. Yet he was apparently favoured by God, whereas others who transgressed were destroyed, and destroyed for seemingly much lesser transgressions. Achan, for example, was destroyed because he coveted the treasure that he had no right to. The man who gathered sticks on the Sabbath day was killed as well, and their sins seemed trivial compared to David's. And God's immediate punishment seemed unjust and disproportionate. But there is a difference. And thankfully, the Bible gives us all the information we need to appreciate what that difference is. The latter two acted in deliberate defiance of God's command. David, however, succumbed to the weakness of the flesh and shows us just how dangerous and deceitful it can be. But otherwise, he was a faithful and God-fearing man. So Brother Collier wrote, if David, previous to his transgression, had deliberately reasoned the matter out and concluded that since God had showed mercy in many other cases, it might be worthwhile to undertake the risk of sinning, we should never have heard of him as an example of repentance. In all probability, he would have been treated with the severity shown to other despisers and willful transgressors of the law. The position is clear enough. It has been commented that since God is so merciful, as he evidently was towards David, then it's important that we should accept his conditions of salvation and make no effort to tempt him further. He has proposed to accept our faith in him and his forgiveness and impute it to us for righteousness. We're conscious of the fact that during our human existence we are continually subject to weakness and temptation. It's our duty and our responsibility then to grow in maturity, to counteract the constant pressures that we face, and also to honour God who has provided us with his word and his assurance. And we don't do this by learning the first principles once and then tucking them away at the back of our mind for future reference while we get on with all the rest that life has to offer. There are lamps to be filled with oil, and a great risk of being caught unprepared without any oil when it's too late to do anything about it. Peter told his readers to grow by the milk of the word. And Paul, who had been through the process of conversion and probably learned more by his experiences than any man, spoke towards the end of his life of the constant struggle that he faced in his own experience, despite his knowledge. In other words, the more progress he made, the more he realised how much further he still had to go. And yet, he was confident that he would stand before a perfect judge at the end. The other aspect we learn from the life of David is, as we said, to do with his ambition to build a temple for God. It was consistent with his zeal for God, and it was part of the way of thinking that God esteemed and which counteracted the sin of his weakness with Bathsheba. The record implies that David saw it as his duty to build a temple for God, to overcome the anomaly that he lived himself in a fine house, but God was worshipped in a tent. But God didn't see his duty in that way. David's plan was not allowed, not because of his sin, but because he had been a man of war. It would have been a great disappointment to David, and yet we read of no resentment and no complaint. David was content with the love God had shown towards him already, and he was willing to restrain himself and simply carry out the preparation which God allowed him to do. The way that David dealt with his disappointment created the environment where God could now reveal his own promise to him, which is rightly regarded by us as a first principle doctrine, the promise to David about his coming son and about the kingdom that was to follow. How much more lies beneath the surface of that first principle? Brother Collier writes, "In this way we obtain a glimpse of God's point of view in pronouncing David a man after God's own heart. There are many who would not have transgressed in the matter of David, but who, if balked in a laudable ambition to build the temple, would have washed their hands of the whole affair." In other words, they would have sulked. So if God sees the fulfilment of our duty in a different way to our own, then it becomes necessary to accept that his way should prevail. A lot of what we said this evening has centred on the first commandment, and to a lesser extent on the second. There isn't time, and probably hasn't been the need, in this subject to go through all the details of the other commandments or to elaborate further on the second. But as Jesus said, on these two commandments, loving God and loving our neighbour, hang all the law and the prophets. One further aspect of the first commandment is that in order to obey it, we have to align our thinking as much as possible to the way that God thinks. Everything else falls into place after this, and it sounds very easy in principle. But making sure that our thinking lines up with God's is actually really hard. It was where Adam and Eve first succumbed. And once their thought had been corrupted, the act of sin followed soon after. But this was where Jesus triumphed. He never gave in to the tempter, and he had to overcome that test before he could carry out his ministry and then follow it through perfectly until he was ready to offer the sacrifice on the cross. So how loving then God was to limit his ministry to just 3 years. So it's our duty and responsibility to constantly deal with the way that the mind works, our minds. It's our duty to feed the mind, and our responsibility to apply what we have been fed. And God has not left us without ample guidance in so many ways. Commands like the children of Israel were given in the way they had to teach their children the law. Wisdom such as we have in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, and scores of practical examples of both good men, good and bad men and women. We have the material to use, but none of that will be of any use unless we apply it. Thinking, then, applies itself in action, faith into works. So finally, it has been commented that there is no need to ask God for an opportunity to serve him, to worry about whether we are performing or have enough to do to perform our duty and to fulfill our responsibility. There are opportunities all around us to obey the two great commands. And quoting again, often in work which seems to have no connection with the purpose of God, there is equal opportunity for faithful endeavour and the manifestation of love. The Apostle shows us that there is scope for rendering service to God even in working for a bad master. Opportunity can be found every day, even under the most prosaic conditions, in other words, dull or commonplace situations, and in connection with matters which would never bring God to the minds of worldly men. None has ground for complaining that prosaic duties absorb all the time and prevent the use of talents. You may dig or sweep the roads and make it a work for God, and you may preach and make it a work for the devil. So, in conclusion, we go back to that passage in Micah for our last thoughts. He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God.